Hello, this is a continuation podcast from the last one about comets. I was interrupted there, but I got up to the stage of saying, look, there's a basic structure of comets. The nucleus, which is the dirty snowball or cosmic potato. The coma, which is the atmosphere when that nucleus heats up. The shockwave, or the bow shockwave. And then the three tails, which are the dust tail, the iron tail, and the anti-tail. In this one, I'll go a bit further more. Sorry, as I cough there. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. What actually the basis of this is that I've read a few books on comets, and the basic physics of what's going on are missing. It seems to be a descriptive world, and for me, that's a very fascinating thing because a lot of people will read a book on comets and assume that's all there is to know. One of the most obvious things that you see when you look up at the sky and see a comet, or you see pictures of comets, is that it's the like a paintbrush stroke, starting off with a definite edge and trailing off. And so as it trails off, it can have different wisps in it, and the Greeks or people thought it was hairy, a hairy star. So coma is hair, a hairy star. The Chinese, I assume, would have seen a bit more structure. They would have seen the anti-tail. So the anti-tail is a line of fairly thick debris which stretches from the comet towards the sun, and that's seen when Earth passes through the plane of orbit of the comet. You see the anti-tail for a brief time. We would have seen the coma, and then the various tails. And this would have looked like a broom, so the Chinese call it a broom star. But one of the things I want to focus on is the shockwave. And there's traditional shockwave physics, and there's a bit of plasma physics which go into this. So one of the things I said is that you can actually generate your own shockwave. What I sort of recommend is getting a chopping board, a see-through chopping board, a plate of glass, or at best a plate, putting it underneath your kitchen tap and running the water so it's just a bit more than dripping. It's actually a continuous stream, and you will see that it will produce a circle where the water hits the plate, pushes up and dams the water up. The water speed changes as it migrates from this shallow area, which is equivalent to the coma of the comet, to a large area, a slowed space. This is the basic idea of a shockwave, and it gives a very good idea of the shockwave of the solar wind into our galactic, more sedentary galactic gas. So we have a bow wave or a shockwave around an entire solar system stretching out well beyond the atmosphere of Neptune, where this process of the solar wind interacts with the outside. Of course, one of the interesting things, if you saw a comet, it looks very much the same shape as an aircraft moving past. You see the contrail passing back, or a ship, if you look at a ship from the above. That's a similar shockwave theory. And so this is one of the things, you read a book on comets and there's no mention of shockwaves. You go, oh, what possibly can be going on here? We'll look into that. Now, firstly, you can well imagine where the atmosphere of the comet is generated. It's like a boiling kettle. You've got something solid. It heats up and it turns to gas. There's a few steps in that, and that then flies out to a certain amount in space. And let's say that it absorbs light, and if it absorbs X-ray light or UV light, remember there's no atmosphere, ozone layer, it's absorbing stuff, there it will photo, a lot of that material will start to break apart. Ions will hit it from the solar wind, light will hit it from the solar wind, And what was a molecule will break into two or multiple molecules as it photodissociates. That is, it reaches a molecule will get excited up to a vibrational energy, and it will vibrate so violently it will just fall apart into two molecules. And the effect is that you're doubling the amount of gas. So the actual gas pressure obviously drops off as you move away from the molecule, away from the nucleus, as the gas goes into space. It's expanding, it's occupying less space. But when it starts to photodissociate, you get a multiplication effect. There's actually more gas generated. So the particle moves off and it starts to break up. It's something called the solar wind. Now, the solar wind is, in actual fact, a wind generated by vibrating magnetic fields of the sun, which heat up the extreme upper atmosphere of the sun and accelerates both, as I understand it, both electrons and protons or nuclei, positive particles, out to space at very high speed, millions of degrees Kelvin. It's effectively an all directions iron gun around the outside of the star. And the way that this is generated, we're beginning to understand this a bit more, is that the center two-thirds of the sun is effectively solid. We call it the radiation zone. But there's no convection there. There's no churning of the sun. It's actually completely placid and still, similar to what you would experience on Earth, the surface of the Earth. And this surface rotates as a solid, rigid sphere inside the sun, shearing against the atmosphere of the sun, which is the radiation layer, the upper, I suppose, 10% of the sun. I really don't know the actual areas. And this buoyancy does occur. The actual pressure allows that when something is hot, it becomes less dense and floats upwards. This churning layer, this shearing creates an intense magnetic field which gets transported to the surface of the sun, vibrates, creates alpha N waves, and undergoes a series of heating areas. So you've got your radiation zone. When the radiation zone starts to thin out very suddenly, it is your photosphere. This is the sun that you can see. Above that is the chromosphere. So the sun goes from 5,000 degrees up to 15 million degrees in the center. Above the photosphere, it goes the chromosphere. And this is where you have the beautiful... it's very low density, very high temperature. The chromosphere, it's the color sphere. The sun is glowing as an iron lamp, and you can see the chromosphere if you have a special filter which filters out blackbody radiation but allows the iron radiation of a lamp. So if you can imagine going through Las Vegas, very famous, but in the 60s, where it was all neon signs, if you had one of these sets of glasses on, which only allowed neon lines through, you could put your glasses on and it would appear night, but you would see the neon lines come through. So you can actually, I'm trying to explain that in a certain way. So you can have filters, glass filters, which only let up only very, very particular lines through. And if you use that for hydrogen and you look at the sun, you can actually see this chromosphere. And this is where the lines, the emission lines of the sun come along. It's not black body radiation, it's atomic line emission. And that, I think, goes for about 2,000 kilometres, a fairly thickish skin of the sun. And above that, the temperature really radically increases and the particles start to accelerate directly away from the sun. So if you go from a line from the very centre of the sun to infinity, draw a line along there, the particles accelerate that way. And the solar wind goes directly directly away from the sun. Now, it is an iron, and there's a magnetic field, so it can get a little curvature to it. And there's a bit of complexity to that. I'm just going to talk about shockwaves in a while. So this solar wind impacts the comet, and it will create a shockwave as the gas from the comet encounters the high-speed solar wind. The two will collide and create a shockwave. For a shockwave, you basically need a basically a velocity and a non-linear equation to say that the actual density will increase. And so what this means is that the actual density of gas will increase around that bow shockwave. Now there's a few more non-linear things. So you can see that shockwave, I think, I suppose if you're water skiing, you'll see it across. If you're in your bathtub and you've got your rubber duck, you can drag your rubber duck and you can see a shockwave, a build-up of water. So all the water is moving, but there appears to be a ripple of additional water there. Now there's another there's another non-linear process there. You've got the light coming in, and it's starting to excite the molecules. And the thing is that an excited molecule, the light does several things. It takes a single molecule or a single chain of something, breaks it into several. So you get one, and it's like gremlins. You've suddenly got 10 of them. But it's not 10. If they go into a metastable state or they're electronically excited, they can increase in size 1,000, 1,000,000 times. So if you can imagine a fly coming to you, squat it, it breaks into 10 little flies, and those flies grow in size to the size of cats. Now, this is an amazing thing. So you hit one, and suddenly this fly breaks into 10 flies, but they're the size of cats. So metastable molecules, and indeed ions, have a huge cross-section. That is, that when a particle's coming past it, the particle can either go through it and miss it or hit it. The cross-section means the ability to hit it. So imagine you're sitting on your porch, you hit a fly, it's gone into all these, broken into 10 flies, the 10 flies have come to cats, and then you've got your little shotgun, you can keep on hitting these cats. Now, these cats can also break up again and form other things. It becomes quickly what becomes something, you hear one of these Aussie birds, that's a sulfur-crested cockatoo coming past. And so very quickly you have a complete breakdown of what's going on. Now, you can see this in a school laboratory. We have these discharge tubes, these cylindrical discharge tubes with a circular a cylinder, a little table, aluminium table, which is your discharge surface. This is, again, historically based on the idea that the rays were light rays, not particle rays coming off these surfaces. So they thought, we need an antenna. So you've got these little disc buttons at the top and the bottom, and you have your high voltage generator. In a school, for some reason, no one's been smart enough to make a small solid state high voltage device for schools and get possibly enough money. You have a transformer, basically a big electromagnet. The electromagnet powers up. When it powers up, it pulls a magnet which breaks the circuit, takes the power off the circuit. This is an interrupter. It breaks the circuit, and you've got a big inductor and a big sudden change in magnetic field. The sudden change in magnetic field then goes to a pickup coil on the outside of this, and this leads to a high voltage spike, and you just connect your high voltage to your tube, and your tube will glow. So when it's when there's no gas in it, electrons will actually travel from the top to the bottom of the tube, and you'll see the electrons hit the glass and fluoresce. And as you induce more and more gas, you'll start to see shock waves build up. And this is where the ions get generated at one end. They accelerate forward and they hit the gas. Now the gas then therefore breaks up, ionizes, becomes these metastable molecules. They then emit light, and so you'll see will be dark, a dark space, and then you'll see a surface equivalent to the surface of your comet, and this will start to glow in this area. And now what's happening is that you can do an equation. The current has to be the same all the way, but the amount of charge carriers increase massively in this shock wave. The charge carriers increase, therefore the actual velocity decreases, because it's the velocity times the amount of charge carriers which go through. And you have other effects that are not so much in space or light, but these particles, particularly if it's not dense, that they produce very fine atomic lines or rotational lines, and the light from one transmits to the other. So there's a radiation coupling, a resonant radiation coupling. And you can see this effect. I've seen it when iron trapping particles in a laser iron trap, one of these fancy 0 degrees Kelvin type of devices, and you tune your laser on, and you've got a tuning range, and when you tune it on into the right region, just roughly the right region, the entire chamber glows with resonant radiation. The light hits one atom, then hits the other. It keeps on going around, so you you get a sort of a resonant effect that increases the effective lifetime. So you have a resonant transition, which say lasts 1 nanosecond, but as you measure it with your photomultiplier, it lasts 100 nanoseconds, because the light goes out hitting 100 individual particles before it can escape. So you've got all this type of effect happening. And I suppose what else happens is, as you increase the pressure even more in your tube, your discharge tube, you eventually get these blue streamers which go from one electrode to the other, where the actual electricity is sufficient to create a small magnetic field, and you get a zeta collapse, and going across, and you have that in a comet as well. But if you see a comet, you'll see this effect. And what happens is that in the first stage, is the gas from the nucleus goes out to the coma, hits the shock wave, and at that point, the dust, which is in effect, I'm actually suffering a bit of smoke. We've got large fires down in northwestern Sydney, and the smoke's coming up here. At the moment, it's autumn, but there's definitely smoke about the place here. But effectively, the dust tail is smoke. It's exactly smoke. If you have fat or a barbecue, before there's any flame, it will start to smoke. You'll see that smoke coming off. These are 10 micron or 5 micron. If it's down to 1 micron, it's a blue smoke. It's a white smoke. You can tell the particle size even out in space. But if you start to look at these particles, you can see that the smoke actually goes out and hangs around inside the coma. And then once it's in the coma, it gets slowly knocked back, or some of it gets knocked back in orbit. So you've got this constant amount of smoke being generated into the coma, and a certain amount of smoke exiting the coma. So in a typical comet, you've got two things. You can have the dust tail coming largely from the nucleus, entrained from the nucleus, and you can get shock waves where it's not necessarily coming from the nucleus, but it's actually being jetted down towards the nucleus. So you've got a large coma and a fairly thin tail, or you can have a fat tail where the actual smoke is generated from the coma. The coma itself. So coma is the name for the cometary atmosphere, and this is where between the nucleus of the comet and the shock wave. And so these are all things to see here. So, but if the smoke is generated out there, and it's there when it undergoes an interaction. Now, people say. When the smoke trail is essentially the smoke which has got is travelling in the same orbit as the comet, it will in the cometary tail it can't keep on going forward because it goes forward it hits the coma. Shockwave. When it hits the shockwave, it slows down. That's the entire thing of a shockwave. Then it can be hit out of that shockwave. So it's actually travelling at the same speed as a comet, and it can actually, if it's travelling towards the sun, interaction with the direct iron impact or light impact will actually slow it down. And so if it slows down, it will not travel as fast, and so it will be in the same orbit as your comet, but a little bit more slow. And so this is why the tail, the dust tail of the comet, follows the orbit of the comet. It's knocked back a little bit and goes further back, and eventually it may undergo more interactions again and actually be lifted up into a really slow, less elliptical orbit. So it will follow the orbital path, stretching back away from the sun, and then start to stretch up. Conversely, after it's gone away from the sun, impact of that in the coma shock wave will be sufficient to hit it and actually projected to go a little bit ahead of the comet, so it will actually start to orbit a bit more quickly than the comet, and the tail again will be in the orbit of the comet, but in advance, and that's how you get the actual structure of the comet. We'll go into the detail a bit more. One of the things I want to talk about is the actual solar wind. The solar wind is just not. It's a little, fairly similar to Earth. There's high speed and slow speed sections of the solar wind. Depending on what the weather is on the surface of the sun, you get different amounts of solar wind, and people, the solar wind will increase massively around solar maxima and reduce during solar minimum. But there are distinct regions of the sun where the solar wind is coming out at different speeds. The interesting thing is that the solar wind and heating of the sun means that it cooks down to the photosphere. The sun is pretty much the same temperature, it's scooped down to the same temperature. So if you can imagine the opposite of an ice cream, say you've got a tub of ice cream and you've left it out on the bench for a while, you can, with your spoon, you can scoop off the light stuff until you get to that hard stuff on the inside. The sun's the opposite. It's actually hotter on the inside, and we have scooped it out so we can see at a certain temperature. And that's in the photosphere. This actually has got this mind-blowing effect called co-rotating areas of interaction. The people, I think, when they got it, decided we'll call it CAI rather than CIA. The CIA being out there beyond Earth orbit was a bit much for them. So I'm just trying to think this is absolutely mind-blowing. So you've got slow solar wind and fast solar wind. Slow solar wind is affected more by magnetic field and curves in. And you have the slow solar wind from different parts of the sun crashing into high-speed solar wind. And similar to comets, this creates a shock wave, and you have this... And the sun is rotating all the time, so this is rotating all the time, and you have these big, probably up to 10 spirals of dense solar wind sort of spiraling in away from Jupiter and spiraling in several times towards Earth, thick layers with shockwave either side. So it's a sort of a real shockwave city. It's hard to describe it. So it's best to go on the internet and see if you can find this co-rotating areas of interaction. There's shockwaves all the way. You can also a comet doesn't necessarily have much magnetic field. You've also got Venus, which is effectively a giant comet. And Venus can, when there is sufficiently gentle and stable solar wind, can develop a cometary tail, an iron tail at the back, which stretches deep across space. Now this iron tail, we'll discuss it next time, this iron tail is really dependent on the purity and the set of things. And so this Venus tail breaks off and gets scrambled up if there's any sort of turbulence. But in a smooth piece of solar wind coming past Venus, you get this huge cometary tail coming off Venus. Next time I'm going to describe the really fascinating plasma physics where you get a rich green colour of comets. I love comets that are green. You get the blue, which is carbon dioxide. So I'll probably try and get a Monty Python skit to explain that green colour. And then the dust tail, which I've sort of done, the iron tail is blue, and that's carbon monoxide going up. And how does that happen? The iron tail, which stretches directly religiously away from the sun, and we'll discuss magnetic fields. This is again a beautiful idea that comets can appear green. Nothing in space appears green, but this appears green, and the overall structure and size and the there is just so rich. It's so much like a kiddie's light show with a torch on the side of a tent. It's something which has been almost too rich with symbolism, has sent cultures into it to a tailspin trying to explain it. So let's go back again. I've sort of read about comets, respectfully read a few books about it, and these people are missing in their description the time to explain to people about shockwaves. Again, maybe not be the thing to explain about shockwaves. And then, again, looking at shockwaves, there's a little bit more to it that the actual... There's photochemistry happening there where, besides the shockwave building a density where the actual... velocity away from the comet stops, obviously. It obviously stops moving forward. It travels at the same speed as the comet. But the fact that it expands and there's all these things happening, it's something hard to see, but it's right out there in space. It's a shock wave out in space. You have to see it there. And the chemistry there, you say, I don't particularly believe this madman on the internet. But if you go into a school laboratory and look at the striations of a low-pressure gas discharge, you'll start to see those shock waves going across. And one of the things that people tend to do, you've got physicists, they're not necessarily chemists, and the actual... but if you do the chemistry or the plasma physics of it, the actual particles that you break off are not the same size. They're sort of like if you smash up a toy... break it into bits, the bits actually expand like this nightmarish process. And just covering off again, these particles can then shrink down, but because it's in space and it's low density, the light that it emits shrinking down is the very light which can actually go and make other bits expand, a sort of resonant trapping. And I don't know whether in the vast volumes of space this is very, very relevant, but it's an effect that you can definitely see in space. So this is the second part. I'll have a third part where I discuss the actual structure of the iron tail and the so-called magnetic field lines. I have a little bit of a beef on that. So look, I really hope that you don't take me as an authority, but I mention things which you say, well, look, I could possibly understand that. And you also have a feeling that there is more to the brief explanation that people give. And I'll give another little talk about why is it that we have these books which actually don't have the full extent of school-grade science that you could actually explain to students to explain things on. And finally, I think I really hope, besides seeing the comet, to actually think of the swirling shockwaves of high-density solar wind, which develops when you get the different parts of the sun colliding with each other and creating shockwaves. This spiral thing, I wish I could give you a... I'm looking up on the roof of my house at the moment and seeing these whirligigs here, but it's sort of like a big spinning spiral galaxy of shockwaves as the light travels out at 500 kilometres per second. Yeah, it's fairly fast. And these shockwaves are these beautiful spirals and they span out. I think an example for you would be like in the 1950s psychology films where they show you these spinning spirals. It's like that, looking up from space, looking at the looking from the North Pole to the South, looking into the galactic centre and seeing the planets orbiting anti-clockwise around the sun, this spiral of shockwaves of solar wind also appears. So there's so much density there, and yeah, that's just my overall feeling. Tell the kids about shockwaves, tell them why there's a shape of a comet, and then they can understand so much more. So this is Peter Hill. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on doing science. Next episode will be a shorter one on some of the molecular spectroscopy from comets. Thanks for listening.